the possibility that other species may have a spiritual aspect to them fascinates me. Like, to me, that makes it even more fascinating about the possibility of a deity, that if God played that kind of role, that it wasn't just for us. Like, I just find that fascinating. The research out there about different species having feelings and all that, I just find that so amazing. So to me, it doesn't necessarily tell me we're less important. It just makes me feel even more connected to everything around me.
You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are...
I'm Kendra Holtmore, PhD student at Boston University, and my favorite board game is Balderdash.
My name is Ian Benz, associate professor of elementary science education at UNC Charlotte. Currently, one of my favorite board games to play is Cards Against Humanity.
Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania, and my favorite board game of the moment is Dixit.
Rachel Jackson, rabbi at Agudas Israel Congregation, Hendersonville, North Carolina, and my favorite tabletop board game to play is cribbage. But I do have to add that I just stumbled upon a game called A Game for Good Christians.
Oh my gosh.
I gotta look that up.
which is like Cards Against Humanity, the Bible version.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the Bible is a nasty book, collection of books. There's a lot in there.
You have to have a particular audience to play that with. So it can't be my favorite game. But it is one of my most recent hilarious finds that I enjoy to play with people that know what the jokes are. So
it always makes an appearance at every young UCC clergy gathering.
Yeah. Now keep in mind, this is a rabbi saying this. So
I got
just throwing
it. Okay.
That one out there.
Right. I definitely need to get this thing. This looks hilarious.
And again, for all you listening, there will be links to show notes. We are not endorsing any of these products as our show, and we do not get a commission for any of them, but we just enjoy having the fun. And apparently, yep. We all like to lie and make fun of people. So that's kind of what our games are showing.
Dixit is about creative storytelling.
Yeah, but it's got a
which
funky
is lying.
Name.
It's creative storytelling is lying. We should have a mini series about the importance of literature and storytelling.
But
and
you
myth.
Still had to spell it out, all right? Because both Kendra and I were like, should we look that up? I mean, I'm at work.
Do I need to put this on private browsing?
Children.
This A Game for Good Christians looks hilarious.
It is. Okay. So that's the game that we like to play. And where are we going with that, Zach?
Like, what is the connection to the thing that we're
I was
game
attempting
of,
to I
the
was
game
attempting
of life,
to make a
obviously.
Segue. No. Okay. But now you just brought up the Game of Life, which is also a board game, which my 5.5-year-old loves to play. And we play that game all the time. And most of the time he has the cat driving, just so you know. Yeah.
There is a metaphor for life in there.
There is.
So in the episode that we launched about Paleolithic religion, I made some passing joke about how I am some large percentage of Neanderthal, large compared to the general population. It's still less than a percent, I think. But I made some joke about how, like, you know, so don't make fun of my people. And one of my beloved church members sent me an email, as he often does. Tongue-in-cheek, but also insightful in the way that only Bruce May can do. And he said in this email, I was struck by the evidence you presented about your connection to Neanderthals, but was more caught up with the one thing you said defensively, jokingly, defensively. You did not want to hear charges about your people. which is a very fancy way to put that, Bruce. What hit me is the term people. Are all our direct ancestors to be considered within that general term? And that got me thinking. Like, yeah, I would consider Neanderthals my people because they look like us. If you were to give one a haircut and dress them up fancy, you wouldn't tell that anything was wrong. They were close enough genetically to breed with us and probably culturally to communicate with us in some way, shape, or form. So it doesn't feel like a stretch. But what about Homo heidelbergensis? That looked a little bit different. Was probably our direct ancestor? Was that a person? Is that my people? What about further back, Homo erectus? I mean, you look at the reconstructions of Homo erectus and it looks human-ish, but still a bit more like an ape. Would I call that my people? Well, what about further back, Australopithecus, the famous Lucy that was discovered in Africa? Lucy looks a lot more ape-like than human, and her brain was half the size of ours, didn't have the capacity to speak the way that we do, walked upright, but that's mostly like the main thing we have in common. And so is she a person? Is she my person? How far back does it go when I can still call that a person? Like, what about the little mouse-like mammal that survived the Cretaceous extinction of 65 million years ago? Is that my people? What about the Dimetrodon? I'm directly connected to the Dimetrodon. Fun fact, not a dinosaur.
Not a dinosaur.
Sad. Closer to the mammals than to the dinosaurs, which
still looks really cool though.
All of my son's dinosaur books call it a dinosaur, and I tell him every single time, and he's like, Dad, I'm four, I don't care. he doesn't say that, but his eyes tell the story. So yeah, the distinction starts to feel more significant the less similar they are to modern humans. The more that I could tell them apart in a lineup, the more difference I feel to them. But the more I think about that, the more I realize that how just arbitrary those distinctions are in the first place. And so the answer, I think, is yes. I think, anyway, that yes, that is my people. And that little mouse was my people, and the Dimetrodon was my people, and that fish that crawled out of the water was my people, and by extension then the oak tree that's next to my church is my people. And it kind of starts to break down these boundaries. We're all kind of made out of broken stars. And so how does that strike y'all? Yes, Kendra.
I think it depends. Like, for what purpose are you claiming someone as your people? Because I think if the goal is just to trace your ancestry in a biological way, then sure, you can like claim so and so as your people. But I just feel like it strikes my ears is very strange to hear that, because I think the like using the phrase my people or claiming, you know, a person or group as your people is a political statement as well. Or like, at least I think that's how I usually hear that. Not that I hear people walking down the streets every day claiming these are my people, but I think it's something that can be used effectively in a political way. To claim a group as your people means that you share something cultural or something in tradition that is meaningful and continuous with your own life and the way that you conduct yourself in public and private spaces. And so there's like a responsibility that you feel to a group that you call your people. And I think even that can be strategic to claim, you know, some of your ancestry as your people in a political moment where it is advantageous to do so. I'm just thinking about like recent politics when like Elizabeth Warren got in trouble for like taking the DNA test
and like finding the percentage of Native American that's like in her background. And I know I'm like moving us into like really modern contemporary stuff, but this is just what comes to my head when I think of like, oh yeah, claiming something as your people. It's like, on the one hand, really innocuous and maybe doesn't really mean that much except in a biological way. But I think it's also something that connects us strategically to a group that can help us like protect ourselves from critique or maybe advance us in status somehow. So I think it actually like is a really like important question, because there are like different interpretations of what it means to claim someone as a people and different purposes for why someone might do that.
Yeah. So like, I think of the closest that humanity has ever come to world peace was the summer that Pokemon Go came out, where you just had people walking around with phones out and just at parks and out on the streets. And if you saw somebody walking down the street with their phone out, you could walk up to them and say like, hey, what team are you on? Go Team Mystic.
Yeah. Or,
right? Woo. Kendra and I are now ultra friends on Pokemon Go, by the way. But like, ooh, I had so many conversations.
Yeah, a few more weeks until we reach best friend status.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah. I didn't know the game still existed.
Well, you're out of the loop. Sorry. So,
but that those couple of months, I met so many people and felt so comfortable going up and talking to them and just laughing with them. And it didn't matter, you know, what they looked like or what how old they were or anything like that. Like, there was just this kinship. Like when I lived in Chicago and living in this sea of blue baseball caps. And then one time on the subway, I saw another Phillies hat. And instantly, like, our eyes locked and we were like, my people, I know you and I love you and I trust you. And we talked and we had this conversation. And I don't know this person. I still don't know this person. But in that moment, I felt like this person was my person, because we had this totally arbitrary connection, but it was enough because we are communal people. That's we're a communal species. It was enough to trigger that family response. So I think it can be manipulated, and we see it being manipulated a lot in politics. Identity politics is historically fairly nefarious, especially when you use it to blame outside peoples for the ills of society. But I think it's also built into who we are. And so by seeing Neanderthal and Homo heidelbergensis and all of them as my people, I hope what I'm doing is helping myself to reconstruct a new narrative of what people means. And so by opening up the net to include species that no longer exist, then I hope, anyway, it would help me to open up the net to my neighbor that does exist, that would not be otherwise traditionally included in my people, air quotes, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think maybe I just interpreted your question as less literal than maybe you intended it.
many thoughts on this. So my first response is what you were just talking about sounds very idealistic and aspirational. I think it's something that we can strive for. And then the reality part of me comes down and says, but having a concept of my people means my people and not your people, or my people and not my people. And that categorization can be used for good and it can be used for bad. Right? I'm clearly not immune to the idea that someone who is not my people can be used against us. But I think as you were just giving the example of the Philly hat, there can be something really powerful in having a deep connection with a particularism rather than a universalism. That maybe there is something okay to be particularistic, that our ideal is, you know, this B'Tselem Elohim and everything is made in the image of God and kumbaya, right? That we're just like an amoeba or a gnat. But I'm sorry, I'm going to kill a gnat. I don't want it floating in my tea. I haven't gotten there yet, and I don't know if I will. Maybe that's a Buddhist concept. But there is something very powerful, and maybe I'm coming at this from a tribalism standpoint and a standpoint of being in a invisible minority, invisible in the sense that I get to choose when people see my minority or not. Mm. It's not written on my skin. That when I walk into a synagogue, when I walk into a Jewish community center, I just know. Right? There's just a calming sense of, okay, I'm with my people. And that's not the same case when I'm just walking out in the street. So I think that there's something positive about that. In a completely different understanding or completely different question around that, what is necessary and sufficient to define who is my people? So if you're even defining, so going all the way back, Zach, to your idea of Lucy, is she my people? Well, what is a person? What defines a person? And I would endeavor, an analogy that I can make is, can you describe a canine to me without using DNA? And how will I know that that canine is a canine and not a feline? So we generally, but you know, when you walk up to a dog that it's a dog. And when you walk up to a cat, it's a cat. Even though, right, they walk on four legs, they have fur, they have sharp teeth, they're both carnivores, they have tails, pointy ears. But then we go, how can an Irish setter be the same thing as a pug? Like, they're both dogs, but they look completely different. Or a Maine Coon and a Sphinx are both them. And that's not even taking into account the individual pieces. Like, there are cats and people and dogs that are born without all of their limbs. Mm-hmm. There's not a particular hair color or eye color that we can say you're in, you're out. So at what point do we say necessary and sufficient to define an object or a category of something? And I really struggle with that, because how then do we decide if Lucy is people or if Lucy is too far removed and is too closer to an ape than a human? What is necessary and sufficient to define that? Because if it's walking on two legs, then why not chickens?
Right. And if it's emotional capacity, why not cows? You know how
elephants or dolphins.
Well, but we have dairy all the time. And the only way to get dairy out of a cow is to get the cow pregnant and then have the cow deliver. Deliver and then take the calf away immediately so that it can lactate. And the cow cries and the baby cries and they are depressed and miserable just so that we can get milk out of them. And we try to keep them pregnant and giving birth consistently so that we can get the most production out of it. And then when they don't have production anymore, we slaughter it for meat. I mean, that whole process only is possible with extreme emotional manipulation. If wherever you draw the line of what makes a people and what deserves rights, that makes me sad more so than almost anything else in factory farming.
Yeah.
I honestly don't care about chickens, and I know that's bad. when I hear about horrible chicken conditions, like, it doesn't bother me as much as the crying cows for some reason. It's totally, yeah. I'm just being honest.
Totally arbitrary.
Arbitrary. It makes no sense.
And as a person who is trying to be environmental in the way that you're eating also, and you're eating grasshoppers and crickets, I can't remember, is it both or just one?
Mostly crickets.
Mostly crickets. Sorry.
Grasshoppers on tacos.
Okay. For the added crunch instead of a...
For all of our Mexican listeners, you know what I'm talking about. That's a real thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You talked about that a couple weeks ago. It was still
talk about it again.
Yeah. So you eat those and you, it doesn't seem to bother you that you're crunching on the brains and the eyes of crickets.
Right.
Right. And that they were, which means that they were fully alive when they, which means they were fully alive when they were killed. And
they're
eating
actually
their entirety.
Crickets are killed by freezing. So right. they put the container in the freezer and they fall asleep and then they die. So it's actually
a pretty humane way
to kill them.
Kind of, but you are making, you know, a death by freezing is still not a good death.
Well, I mean, they don't give them one last meal and then a little lethal injection or there's
God,
no
that's horrible
tiny
too.
Guillotine or whatever. they have to keep costs down. Imagine there being a little tiny like grasshopper priest who's there to give last rites to all the little grasshoppers. How long that would take?
There must be a Far Side cartoon practical. Somewhere in this.
It's just not practical.
Okay, so Kendra or Ian, do you have before Zach and I dominate the entire conversation?
Well, it's just another one of those. It's interesting to listen to you two. So, but while talking about, you know, our people, and it just kept making me think about the question of what does it really mean to be human? And it's not necessarily a question I can easily answer, but it's something that Answers in Genesis has put up a couple of times on Twitter. And I'm always just amazed by the, you know, claims made by organizations like that about what it means to be human.
What sorts of claims?
Well, so, I mean, it's has all this talk at the beginning in their article about the science and stuff that's been coming out, scientific discoveries and research that's been reported. But, you know, then just finally gets into the, well, you know, what it means to be human is, well, and then they use phrases like evolutionists can do this and evolutionists can do that. I'm always like, oh, come on. But just talking about how we have humans have a spiritual nature that no animal possesses. How do we know that? And is that even an accurate statement to make? Like, can we really know that?
I think for a lot of people, it doesn't really matter whether we can know that. I think it's more about the, like, feeling, like, appealing to feelings or, like, morality or just, like, narrative that sets
right.
humans apart as something that's different and special. And that is really important for a lot of a lot of religious people, but Christians, since you brought up Answers in Genesis, like evangelical Christians, because I think having human beings set apart as something different is really important for this like redemption narrative of like being
yeah.
special mm-hmm. and loved by an omniscient, omnibenevolent God. And so I think it doesn't really matter if the science backs it up or not, because it's supposed to be something that you feel like in your heart and soul, and there's no science that can, you know, refute that. And I think that's why, I don't know, it's kind of a weird juxtaposition, because you do have something like Answers in Genesis that is trying to set itself up to be like really scientific, but
right.
there's this paradox of like trying to use the authority of science without really like committing oneself to like a rigorous scientific method. But it's sexy for any, and this isn't just something that like Christians do. All kinds of people love to use the authority of science to forward an agenda, because in general, people, they do respect science. It's something that you can like sense and see as truth in some basic sense, but whenever it rubs up against something that's like really existential, then people start to feel a little hesitant. Like, it's easy to love science when it's kind of supporting what you already know to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a lot of that going on.
Well, and to me, and that all makes sense. I think, you know, that just shows the difference between me and someone who holds that perspective, that the possibility that other species may have a spiritual aspect to them fascinates me. Like, to me, that makes it even more fascinating about the possibility of a deity, that if there is, you know, if God played that kind of role, that it wasn't just for us. Like, to that, just find that fascinating, you know. And, you know, the research out there about different species having feelings and all, it just, I just find that so amazing. So to me, it doesn't necessarily tell me we're less important. It just makes me feel even more connected to everything around me and to other species, and more responsible for my actions, and just more appreciation for nature when I'm, you know, see things and realize that there's a reason why this particular species does these types of things and stuff. And, you know, it's been a long time since I've read it, but it makes me think back to that book, When Elephants Weep. Did you guys ever read that? It came out over 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago. And so it was fascinating because, I mean, I barely remember it, but I remember it was talking about experiences of seeing different species react in ways when it came to, like, kind of like the loss of a loved one, loss of a family member, and just how they would react, and using that to talk about emotions within other species. I find that so amazing that it's not just limited to us.
Yeah.
So, and it, again, back to the, it makes me feel a greater sense of responsibility. That doesn't mean that if I see a spider and it's in my room in an enclosed environment and it's looking at me, that I'm not going to kill that thing. I am majorly afraid of spiders. And so, but out in, it's funny, when I'm out in nature, I'm typically fine with them. But it's more of a, if there's one crawling on me in a car, yeah, I'm going to freak out. And don't ever have me drive in and that happen, because that has happened. And if you guys are in the car, you'll see what happens. And I just flip out and as quickly as possible pull over to the side of the road and run out of that car screaming. Just ask Anne. Anyone who's listening can ask my wife. She knows. So anyway.
But I think what you just bring up with that spider example is very true. If we expand that, it's that we get afraid when someone's in, when someone, something is in our space.
Right.
When it's my people. So if you're dealing with my people, of which I put myself in that category, then there's reason to create a barrier between us. But if we're in a neutral space or nature, which is their home, then it's okay. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we bring the conversation back to how humans interact with other humans, we all feel, I think that that would be very similar. That when you're on my turf, it's, you know, my house, my rules. And I get afraid if, and then act out on that fear, based on that fear, if you challenge me in some sort of way. But if we're in a more neutral ground, then we're more able to hear one another. And right. We're able to, so we go from the particularism to the universalism, depending on the environment we find ourselves.
So there was a pod of orcas, or killer whales, in Twofold Bay and off the coast of Australia, who between 1840 and 1930, so 90 years, this pod worked alongside local fishermen to herd migrating baleen whales into the bay, so that the whalers could kill them, and then they would feed the orcas for their good deeds. And this is something, they didn't train them. They didn't, like, raise them and then send them out to go hunt like dogs. This was just a thing that one of them did once. Old Pom was the patriarch of the pod, and it just became a thing that they did, was that this time of year, the orcas would herd a whale or two into the bay, they'd slaughter it, and then they'd share the meat between the village and the whales. And this wasn't just like a couple of whales that did this. This was 90 years. And so they were teaching their whale children, and it became cultural. It was like the whale pod culture, the orca culture, not just the local whalers, but like they had culture. And there's some evidence to say that some of the songs of whales are cultural and not just like how a spider has the information for a web built into the DNA, but it's something that they're creating, that there's a creative process in whale songs that we don't really have evidence of animals that make art. And we've often thought about art as an expression of the soul, of a sort of human uniqueness. You can teach an elephant to paint, but it doesn't paint creatively. It paints what you teach it to paint. So at least with whales and their big old emotional brains, it seems like if there's any species out there that has some spiritual capacity, it might be them.
See, and again, that just absolutely fascinates me to think to myself that, man, it's possible that, okay, so if that's there because of God, that means that it could be there for other species because of God. And that's just so cool. Like, that's just so amazing to even think like that, to explore that. And yes, I'm fully aware there are probably scientific explanations for all that stuff, and people are looking into that, and that's fine. It doesn't bother me at all. It doesn't make me lose my spirituality. I just, again, that's just the connection that we develop. And so when I learn about the discovery of different past human species and our connections to them, and you know, the idea about, you know, Neanderthal DNA and mixed with our DNA, Homo sapiens, and again, I just find that so amazing. And I guess it sometimes saddens me that people are like so threatened by that. Like, it's just so amazing, so that we are able to figure that stuff out and think about the implications there. And you know, the episode that just came out talking about, you know, art and those types of discoveries and everything, it, you know, and the burials that were talked about, what was that with Brianna's episode, was so cool, just talking about, okay, well, what are the implications for that? And again, it's fascinating to me.
I've sort of lost track of the question, or like the what we're talking about.
We're going down the wormhole.
Well, I was about to say that seems like a logical place to then ask what bubbles to the surface for any of you in this discussion of human origins. What did we miss, or what does it stir up inside of you? Where are the connecting points for you?
Mm-hmm. It makes me really wish that I'm going to get all science fiction here, but I really wish there was a way that we could invent a time machine and go back and get more evidence about different human species. And like some of the things that were discussed with Brianna and our other episodes, I wish there was a way we can get even more evidence to better understand their culture and potential spirituality. I would love, like, that would be so cool.
I want to see classical Egypt when everything was still painted. All of the statues. I want to see the pyramids still coated in glimmering limestone. Like, I want to see these old cultures as they were and not as they are today.
I want to know about the change of language, how we moved from environmental language, such as careful lion over to the right, and right, so basic language skills above and beyond what we understand animals to have, which is, you know, the elephant saying careful lion and run and it very, but more particular about that, but still in completely environmental, to imaginative, to fabricating. And then the person who decided that they needed to write that down, to capture it in some way, whether that was through painting or through letters of some kind, and how we made that transition, and what made us want to perpetuate in that way. That's where I see us continuing this conversation. And one of the ways that I look at nowadays is with our technology. So we have very little about prehistory because it wasn't written down and things decomposed. And then we look at early history where it was written on papyrus or rocks or things that also don't really withstand the test of time. And then we slowly have developed a love of books and a desire to keep them. And this codex form or a scroll form seems to be pretty hardy as long as we're keeping it. But here we are now in the 21st century where the majority of our conversation and ideas are not physical. And, you know, where do you put a floppy disk? Where do you put your hard drive? I mean, we're looking at technologies that are 20 years old that we have no ability to recreate. How are we possibly going, like, oh, I've got a thumb drive now, but will that thumb drive technology still be existent in 100 years from now? And if that's where all of our writings are, if that's where all of our ideas come from, how are we going to move forward? How is this time going to be looked at? So it's about looking at the past so that we can understand the present.
I think the idea of tracing a language back really resonates with me. And what you're saying, Rachel, just about like the decay of those ways that we record stories and culture. I, for the new year, have started journaling. I go through phases of journaling in my life, but I felt inspired for the new year to start back up for a while. And a friend told me of the way that she journals, which is to, like, no matter what you have to say or don't have to say, every day you write 3 pages in your journal.
Wow.
And if you don't have anything to say, then you just write over and over, I don't have anything to say, for 3 pages. And that is just like the limit that you have and that you have to complete every day. And she said that, I don't know like where this method comes from, but for her, it was very therapeutic and it just forced her to put pen to paper and to really process her thoughts. Even I think part of the reason to have that limit is like, even if you don't want to write, you still have to, like if you have this limit in mind, the page limit. So anyway, that's what I've been doing. So I've been thinking a lot about journals and diaries and just like notes that I have written over the years and some that I still have, some that I don't have. And I joked around recently with Chad about how sometimes I write in my journal like something that I just think, ah, well, 500 years from now, archaeologists are going to dig up my journal. And so I have to be careful about what I say and the way that I phrase
things. That's a really good point.
Not totally private, you know, when I become a famous, you know, whatever, like artifact.
Podcaster.
And so I was joking around with this, with Chad about this. And I was just reflecting on like the things that we could never know about these like old peoples or like everything that we've been talking about, pre-human history, that like before writing was invented. It's just like, it's amazing how much changes when you have the ability to write and when your language changes in such a way that it just, it's recorded through these new forms. And I think sometimes if I lived in a period of time before writing was invented, I think I would be a different person. There's something about writing that I think changes the way I process myself. And so I really wish that writing like had always been around, because I would love to know the journal thoughts of the Neanderthals and
right?
like what could we learn from those histories if we could consume them in the way that we now are so familiar with and like take for granted. That's obviously impossible, but this is just one of my daydreams.
ever read the graffiti that was discovered in Pompeii?
Yes.
The writings from the ancient world that we have are the writings of rich and powerful people, right? Because the scribes continued them. But there's graffiti on the walls of Pompeii, like there is in every place, and the volcano preserved it. So it's all this writing of just like common folks, and Pompeii was kind of a trashy city. It was like Vegas for rich people. You know, there's brothels everywhere, and just it was a vacation destination. And I can't read you most of these because I'm in my church office, and I can't say these things.
Really? I'm going to look this up.
However, they're hilarious too. There is one that I think is just so sweet at an old bar. It says, "We two dear men, friends forever, were here. If you want to know our names, they are Gaius and Aulus."
Hmm. Aw, that's so cute.
Right? Two best friends getting a drink together at the bar, carve in the wall, like BFFs forever, and we still know their names. And I think that is so sweet. And like, I don't know what they did. They didn't conquer the world or whatever, but you know, they were best friends and we know their names. And I don't know.
And here's another one. And of course, links in the show notes. "Beautiful girl, you seek the kisses I stole. Receive what I was not alone in taking. Love. Whoever loves, may she fare well." Hmm. It's just people hanging out with their besties and unrequited love and the same thing that we've all been going through time in memoriam.
Here's one at the bathroom.
Hey, from love hey to pooper, the bathroom.
"Hey, pooper, may everything turn out okay so that you can leave this place."
That's so, yeah, just outside the gates. Defecator.
Yeah. So what kind of a legacy will you leave, I think is the question.
But seriously, there are all kinds of interesting things in the bathroom stalls. At Boston University, at least.
Have you noticed that since smartphones became a thing, there is far fewer graffiti on bathroom walls?
So yeah, people are, that's a good point.
They're looking at their phones. They're not writing things on the walls anymore.
You should come over to some of these bathroom stalls at BU. I sit in there for minutes longer sometimes, just reading everything on the walls.
Would you be willing to take a picture, Kendra, and send it over so other people that won't get the ability to be in the bathrooms of BU can enjoy this as well?
I could try, but I have noticed that at least in a couple of the bathrooms, every once in a while, facilities will come in and just like kind of paint over it or like, you know, give it a fresh look.
Give it a...
And
well, if it happens, we would be able to enjoy our own graffiti.
Yeah.
That is hilarious.
See, now you guys got me all like really wanting to know more about the graffiti there, because I saw a few and I'm like, what? So some of it is really interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Listener at home, just pause the podcast wherever you are and find the link in the show notes to take you to some of these wonderful graffitis.
Yeah.
Make sure you're on your own personal server.
Absolutely.
Or even this medium. Right? This podcast medium where we have and share ideas and discuss things, and we're just everyday people. Right? It might not be graffiti, but we're not the rich and powerful making decisions. And how will our conversations be recorded again in the future beyond this time frame? I think it's something for us to be able to think about, and whether or not it comes from a place of vulnerability of, oh man, what are they going to read in my diary, or a place of pride and saying, yep, I literally had nothing to say today, so now you have 3 pages of nothing. Because nothing happens, because when you're just an everyday person, some days are completely not memorable, and that's okay. there was a study done sort of saying, are modern day humans happier? And are they worked more or less? Because we constantly think that the foragers, the hunters and gatherers, worked such, right? They worked all the time and they struggled. And nah, they really didn't. They had plenty of time for gossip. They had plenty of time just to sit around the campfire and knit and enjoy each other's company and not stress. And even the most disparate of the people had, 30, 35 hour work weeks. And what that says about us and how we, the everyday person. I think that's what so many of us are interested in. And when we find examples, we realize that these are my people, that regardless of if they're 15,000 years ago and they're foragers and scavengers, that they want the same things we do. They want to be able to watch their children grow. They want to know that they're going to live without pain. They want to be able to be within community as large as they're able, right? Emotionally and as well as physically. And they want to know that when they die, they will be remembered. And to me, that is the people. And if that's someone from 15,000 years ago, or the person next door, or the person a world away, that's what we want. And I think that that's, it expands to some of our non-human creatures in this world too. That's what they want. So I hope we get there.
This has been episode 24 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. If you'd like to support the show, check us out on Patreon or at our website at downthewormhole.com. Seriously, every little bit helps us to grow this podcast and this work, which we feel is so important. If you're unfamiliar with Patreon, it's kind of like the public radio model, but for the digital age. You sign up for a regular monthly amount of giving that you feel comfortable with, and then there are progressively more awesome perks depending on how much you give, including a patron-only Discord channel, a patron-only podcast, the ability to choose future episodes, and more. Check it out at patreon.com/downthewormholepodcast, or just click the link in the show notes. Hopefully this will enable us to do more with this podcast and reach more people with this work. Next week, we are beginning our mini-series on the climate crisis and environmental justice, but we're taking a different kind of approach than usual. Instead of teaching you about the science, we are approaching it from our own emotional connections. So each week, a host will lead a science-based discussion about an element of the topic that we feel particularly passionate about. I'm going to kick us off next week as we get talking about the hidden environmental cost of food and food production and how we can use this moment in history to think bigger and healthier and more connected than ever before. And now, a final word from Kendra, which was recorded after we finished and will be the kind of life-changing insights that you can come to expect from our patron-only podcast in the works.
If you can watch The Mandalorian and not cry watching Baby Yoda save The Mandalorian from a mudhorn, then you're a monster.